So, good morning. We will kick off now. So, welcome to yet another of what promises to be an enthralling entry into our webinar series. And this is following very closely on from our AI risk management webinar that we carried out and delivered a week or so ago. But this time we're going to be diving much deeper into this subject, specifically focusing on the EU AI Act. So what is it? What does it mean for organizations? Who does it apply to? And why any of us really should care? And to assist on this, we've enlisted the expert help of one of our key partners, Cyera. And I will introduce Ash fully shortly. But it's very clear that AI is here, it's part of our daily lives, but also very much on the rise. And by the rise, we're talking about organizations that are scrambling to implement and harness AI systems to gain that competitive edge. And that's what we're really talking about today, is not so much that threat from AI, that we'll talk about polymorphic malware and other threats, but really our implementations of AI. And there are many different aspects to AI security, including data security and privacy, model bias, exploiting vulnerabilities like prompt injection, and of course, regulatory compliance. And there are now sort of many AI risk management frameworks that can help. They're all very important, but the one that really matters, that is regulatory compliance and AI, the EU AI Act, which is the one that we need to care about, is the one that organizations must adhere to. Which leads us very nicely to today's webinar and the introduction of my guest today on the webinar, and that's Ash. So Ash Hunt is a technology information security risk and product executive, formerly of FTSE 250 CISO for Sane Group, global CISO for Apex Group, and he's worked extensively across UK government, FTSE Fortune 500, and CNI organizations, leading multi-million dollar enterprise programs and multidisciplinary teams in highly regulated, acquisitive, and high-growth environments. He operates as a board and VC advisor, supporting global technology product innovation and strategy, as well as an international keynote, having previously served as a media commentator for Sky News and ITV on cybersecurity issues. He is currently vice president of EMEA strategy at Cyera. So, Ash, very much a big welcome to the webinar, and obviously some great credentials there to talk us through and help us in today's topic.
Thanks ever so much, Richard. It's great to be here.
Brilliant. So before we kick off, I'd just like to remind everybody on the webinar that we have our QA function. So you should see that at the bottom of your screen. So please dive into it. Please use it, and ask myself and Ash some testing questions, all on the subject of the EU AI Act, but we may entertain others. So let's kick off. And I think the best place for us to kick off is very much with a poll. So, Rebecca, if you could launch the poll for us. And that poll is, how prepared are you for the EU AI Act? So our options there are very prepared. We have the Act fully covered. Have we got that poll running? I can't see it pop up. There we go, just on our screens now. So very prepared. We have the Act fully covered. We're prepared. We understand our obligations under the Act and have a strategy to mitigate them. Somewhat prepared, we understand our obligations, but when we're building that strategy, we're at the starting point. We're trying to understand our obligations and how to address them. And then lastly, maybe for for those, or hopefully very few on the call, what is the EU AI Act? So, Tony, we'll just give you a few seconds just to click those answers and to put your vote together, and then we'll have a look at it and see, where we are as a collective group. So we'll just wait to those coming up. And, some interesting results there. I think, Ash, we probably want to have a one-to-one with the very prepared. We have the Act fully covered. Put your hand up and let us know who you are. But I think it's probably what we expect to see, that most people are really at that starting point, or they're just starting to build that strategy around their obligations and how they can cover those, mitigate them under the Act. So actually, just I guess a starting question, is that what you're seeing across organizations and across industry?
I think so. As a general trend, most organizations are taking their embryonic steps towards governing AI within their businesses. A lot of the time, that isn't regulatory backed in the sense that it's not coming from an impetus from the regulators, because as we'll go through shortly, this is the first global regulatory command for AI within the enterprise. But I think a lot of organizations are grappling with the pace at which the business wants to deploy AI, and the security and technology functions rapidly playing catch up in both, it's not blocking it, being an enabler, but to do so in a secure manner, and actually to ensure that it can ultimately scale and succeed on the use cases that the business has in its mind. So I think that's definitely what I'm seeing, both not just within the EMEA region, but broadly more globally.
Yeah, indeed. And, very, similar to GDPR, the EU really leading the charge on the regulatory compliance. I don't know if there's other countries are following suit, and getting their house in order. But off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. I don't know if you've got any insights on that, Ash.
I definitely suspect that the US will come up with a form of legislation, given the way, when I look at particularly from the investment side and the way the markets are structured there currently, I suspect it won't be aggressive in any means. I think they are definitely going to have incentivizing innovation at the forefront of their mindset, given the amount that the current administration has put into backing this as a key part of the future economy. I suspect where we're likely to see a more heavy-handed approach will be perhaps in Asia. So certainly in my past career, when I was answering to groups like the Monetary Authority of Singapore, the HKMA, those regulators are extremely scrutinous, and that was on technology that we had a pretty good grip on. So I think when it comes to this activity that is ultimately going to define the future enterprise, I suspect they're going to want to put very strict guardrails in place to ensure the security of the businesses, and particularly systemic security, right? So very heavily actuarial-based nations, so big insurance groups, markets across Asia, they are going to be particularly concerned with systemic loss. And we'll cover the supply chain piece in a minute, but I think that would be an important thought at the forefront when they develop their own legislation.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I think everyone's going to have to with how embedded it is in our lives and how critical it is to and how critical it will become in every organization. As you say, it's all about ensuring the safety of those organizations, which ultimately will lead to growth in that country, or the opposite, should the worst happen. So I
Right.
think let's kick off, and Ash, I'll just oh, I didn't move my slides there as part of the introduction, but I think I'll just hand off to you just to really cover AI and the as the foundation of the modern enterprise security.
Yeah, so I saw a couple of people said that they might not be aware of what the act is, and I think it definitely hasn't have necessarily the same sort of press release, I guess, as GDPR did at the time. But I think it will be the first sort of sounding gun for defining the way that we structure the modern enterprise. And I just as a backdrop before we sort of discuss the act, I think essentially enterprises are going to undergo a fundamental re-architecture in the next half a decade and beyond. And what I mean by that is the kind of technology that we're now deploying is fundamentally different. It's a paradigm shift from everything that we had before. And as a result, a lot of the controls that we've built, both for securing that technology and enabling it, are going to need to change. They're going to need to adapt. And you can see that from the stats on the side that this is already happening. Okay, so arguably it would have been great if we were having these conversations 3 or 4 years ago. But when the explosion happened a couple of years ago, we're now having to play a pretty rapid catch up. But I do think we shouldn't underestimate just how fundamental a shift this will be for, I think, particularly the mindset and the frameworks that we've adopted. And so the EU have put together this act as the first piece of regulatory legislation in the world for AI. And the lofty goal is to ensure that these systems that we're deploying are safe, transparent, traceable, non-discriminatory, and of course, environmentally friendly. Now, there's some of those things we have more control of than others, I think, particularly depending on how involved you are in your supply chain. But I think the intent is sound, okay? This is the first effort, the first step to ensure that we're getting a grip on the systems that we're deploying. And I think part of that has come from the pace. So the legislators are seeing that these technologies, whether it's AI agents, models, pipelines, applications, are already being rapidly deployed with pretty rudimentary understanding of what they're actually doing. And if you think particularly about how heavy an audit culture that we have also across this region, you can understand the concern of the regulators to want to ensure that we have mechanisms to validate both the secure build, the secure deployment, and the secure validation and assurance of all of these AI systems. And you'll sort of hear this word crop up, I think, increasingly going forward, but organizational trust. Obviously, because we're deploying non-deterministic inference engines to at least an extent, it has thrown in the mix now. And I know we've used it in security previously, but definitely the concept of trust, that can your consumers, can your customers actually validate that they're getting the thing that they hoped they were getting or told they were getting?
Yeah, I
And
definitely agree that that trust is so important. And you're right, that rate of change that we've seen over the last couple of years, and so many examples of that race for competitive edge, but actually not understanding fully the impact. How many times have we heard the stories of prompt injection or chatbots giving away sensitive information just by being effectively brute forced overall? And in terms of trust, actually have got a guest on Thursday. We're talking about sort of quantum secure quantum post-quantum encryption and what that means. And again, that's another great example of that potentially break trust in organizations and encryption, which can have a huge effect not just on people and organizations, but potentially if we look at the banking sector, impacting people's confidence that transactions are correct. So I think trust is becoming such a key foundational or fundamental element of security, which is funny because we've also got zero trust on the side there. But actual real trust, I think, is really important.
yeah, I fear that this term trust will stick with a bit more credibility and the enthusiasm than zero trust has across the technology industry. But I think that, and you're absolutely right. And the last point that I'd mention here is I do believe that regulatory readiness will now become much more of a competitive advantage in the same way that I think speed to market will. So again, underpinning that concept of trust, the quicker organizations can validate that they've either they're already regulatory compliant or they're proactively taking the steps to become so, that's going to instill trust in their customer and their consumer base. And I think that's really going to start becoming one of the key, almost like the KPIs, right, between their competitor organizations in their market space. So I think it's a good thing for regulation. And I think ultimately it's probably going to be a good, as I said, embryonic step into beginning to secure AI and govern AI within organizations.
Yeah, and you mentioned we'll come on to third-party risk a little bit later, but again, I think that's key in terms of trust, and the scrutiny will change with how we look at and view third parties around their AI use. So, Joe, just I'll probably just move us on and really part of that defining the act and talk about sort of the posture and tolerance, which I think helps us build out. Well, actually, what is the where is the act being applied?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't sort of need to go into this into massive depth, I think largely because I think chunks of this still don't apply, at least en masse at the moment. But this is essentially the AI risk category framework that the Act put in place. And it's pretty straightforward in that it's ranking the type of AI system that's being deployed in a broad severity bucket, going from unacceptable, high, through to limited and minimal risk. Ultimately, as I said, when you're looking at this en masse, I think a lot of what the Act is really geared towards governing are obviously nth degree sort of tail end examples, which will sit in the unacceptable risk AI systems. But for the vast majority of organizations, they're not going to be deploying technology anywhere near that. I think a lot of our attention is ultimately going to be between limited and minimal risk systems. And you can see at the very bottom there that as the sort of risk under the, or at least in the EU's eyes, increases, there's a greater burden, greater obligation on the organization to validate and provide assurance. I think for a lot of the systems, whether it's like the general AI models and generative AI, that's typically used by a lot of end users in the organization, or at least back in the systems that where we use things like machine learning, neural networks, deep learning in our tech stacks. You can see that the requirements are pretty straightforward, as they have been with the expectations of any other technology system that we've deployed. How that assurance is provided, I think, is going to be the real challenge for organizations because, like I said, when you're using non-deterministic and inference engines, it's very difficult to log something where the outcome can't be repeated with exactitude. And I think this is the thin end of the wedge. I think it's going to get a lot more challenging to do that over time as the sprawl of the systems, and particularly agentic orchestration, which I'll cover off later, as that gets bigger and broader across the organization, being able to track and govern and have true end-to-end observability over that's going to be a real challenge. I think the one thing that I would definitely encourage as a takeaway for organizations at the moment is with the minimal risk AI systems, which is again where a lot of this is sitting in today, a lot of the use cases, I would encourage them to be proactive with the regulator. It's a technique I used to do as a global CISO, both in public and private organizations, but I wouldn't wait for them to come to me. I would proactively push information to them. One, it gives me sort of full sort of checks and balances if they ever want to say that I wasn't aware of something or that they weren't. So it ensures accountability across the kind of regulatory relationship. But I think also you want to work together ultimately. And if I'm seeing things in my environment that are, I think, either unique or maybe not, and that other organizations will be challenged by, it's only going to strengthen the regulatory documentation that's produced. It's only going to strengthen the work they do with the broader market. So I would say definitely do that. Transparency is key. Key to underpinning that trust that we mentioned as well. And I think also one of the challenges we are going to see as well is because of the rate of deployment, both the speed, pace, and complexity of the AI that we're pushing across the organization, I think things like disclosure windows are going to become a real challenge, right? It's something we struggle with in incidents anyway. Richard, I know you're a CTO, you must have been through thousands of incidents as well. It's incredibly challenging to do that even for things like a data breach when you're stuck doing digital forensics, et cetera. Now imagine that happening tenfold, hundredfold across the organization simultaneously. So I think that's where I think there's room for working together on how strictly the EU plans to enforce this risk categorization.
Yeah, no, indeed. And you're right. I mean, and sometimes, trying to understand what's actually being touched or stolen or during a breach, changes over time. So it's, very difficult. And I think you're bang on there that it's only going to get, more challenging. And I think just a question, and particularly for those that are, sort of developing their knowledge around the act itself, the implementation of that, or the, it's not going to be a certified job. We are certified compliant, more self-certification, more GDPR, looking at it after the event to see if you were compliant or not, and then applying the fines. Is that correct?
I think so, at least for the time being, although I would not be surprised that when there is a first major incident that will either contribute to significant downtime or indeed a serious breach of trust, personal data, whatever it might be, I suspect the EU will change tack pretty fast. They're always waiting and wanting to put more more burdensome activity onto organizations, so give them the opportunity and they'll jump at it. But I think that's an inevitable outcome, if I'm brutally honest. I also think at the moment where organizations with GDPR, I think so, again, some of those goals were, I've never been in an organization that's been fully compliant. I just haven't. I've never even seen one. So I think with this as well, what the EU is really driving at is just trying to get the fundamentals right. But I think back to your point, Richard, and I think it's a great one. That self-certification, I think, will become incredibly important. I think because this is the first time where we're in a kind of symbiotic exercise between the consumer and us within the enterprise technology environment in terms of deploying the same technology in many cases. So particularly when it comes to generative models, they're seeing that tech and they're using it day in, day out in their own personal lives as much as they are within the organization. And so for the first time, they are going to be pretty much on the ball and aware of, okay, I know that I'm engaging with this tech. Do I want to trust an organization that's using it, that is self-certified with the regulator versus one that isn't? And I think those are the kinds of questions that our consumers are going to start asking. And I think they will ultimately become a lot smarter with this, with technology as time goes on, because they're going to be interfacing with it completely differently. And I think organizations and the internal enterprise tech environments should be prepared for that.
No, I do. And I think there might not be a certification right now, but things like the NIST, I've actually forgotten the acronym that goes on the end of that, but
Missed
and
it.
ISO, I'm gonna probably get this one wrong as well, 42,000, that are putting those frameworks to govern AI security. I think that's probably a shift that organizations need to take. So they've got that evidence, they've got that approach that's helping shape that to a certain extent. Which again, when it comes to third-party assessment, it's one thing with our end users, but also with other organizations. So that's great. I think we've looked at and covered off the those kind of risk categories. And I think probably touching into some of the particularly from data security perspective, what's mandated, what's measured, or what do you need to measure?
Yeah, I think again, the EU is hopefully trying to, I hope, trying to build a sort of common theory and mindset when it comes to developing the regulation in the technology space, and that actually this is building off of many of the principles that you'll see in GDPR. Certainly for their high risk category AI systems, there is a very strong emphasis on how the systems are being trained, how the organization is validating the outcome of these the systems are producing, and actually how they're being tested on a continuous basis moving forward. And actually, this is kind of, again, a lot of the shared principles that we're evolving with when it comes to software testing and continuous penetration testing of our systems within the organization. But I think where the Act is making some very specific call-outs is particularly in the rigor that it is expecting organizations to now have over the handling and protection of data, obviously particularly with PII or secure sensitive secrets, etc., and any thing class the sensitive data. But I really think that it's speaking to something broader about the way that we've never really tackled this problem well in the past. And I've been attempting data governance programs for well over a decade in my career, and they always fall apart. Similar with IGA programs on the identity side, and I'll touch on that in a second as well. But I think this is where the Act is really reinforcing some key principles, and that it sees them completely bound to operational resilience, which I think is crucial, right? That particularly when we talk about resiliency efforts, a lot of the discussion is typically towards restoring, rebuilding the app stack, and to ensure that a business process can continue. Well, one of the key parts that organizations tend to forget about that is the data recovery, being able to actually have a very clear RPO. And in fact, having been answerable to the SEC in my career, Sarbanes-Oxley controls, if you're in a banking institution or if you're in a financial services organization, you can't just recover a financial transaction process unless you can get back to the exact point between the last point where things went off, switched off, or were corrupted, etc. So you have to be able to provide end-to-end integrity of your data as well throughout processes. And I think that's a step change that organizations haven't yet fully tackled with. And so the key thing that the and this is a lot of the R&D work that we're doing at Cyera, but the key thing that the Act is really getting for is that we have to be able to measure our data, govern our data, control our data in a way that we hadn't before. And I think even basic questions like who's accessing it, who actually did access it in the past, what are they doing with it, where's the data going? If you look at data throughout its entire life cycle, I think those are hard questions to answer, particularly when you look at the exponential growth of data estates. So the problem metastasizes super fast, and organizations are left struggling to catch the reins and begin to govern this. And I think this is where the Act wants you to think. This is what it wants you to think about. And you can see that for some of those higher risk systems, there are some pretty steep fines. Again, getting into the tens of millions for that, and definitely into just under the 10% of organizational turnover. So I think this is the foundation, if you want to see it, of then securing the rest of the AI problem that the Act is going after.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think you definitely called out at least three areas of security that I think the word you use there that's important, attempted, whether it's data governance, whether it's IGA, these things that and data, that data security perspective of where data is, who's accessing it. And you could argue, actually, John, this act shouldn't be the just the pure catalyst. We should already be looking at that, with GDPR being able to answer those questions. And actually, just for our own need to secure our data, critically important that that we understand these. But as always, we seem to be on catch up. I mean, we could sit here and talk about basic cyber hygiene, which everyone bangs on about. I bang on about it all the time. That just doesn't get done, and I think it's important to really look at how we can address these and how we can do it in a modern way. I think you said at the very start, just how quickly our infrastructure, our states and environments are changing, and how much they're going to change. And that sort of rate or pace of change, we need to make sure that our approaches and our tools keep pace with that, to make sure that they're accurate. And particularly when it comes to data, how many different places is our data stored in? So how do we have a full view of exactly where all that data is? And as you say, who has access to it? Who has accessed it? I think are important questions we need to enable ourselves to be able to answer, particularly so we can avoid some of these fines, which are definitely not trivial, that will impact organizations. So just sort of, we talked about trust, and so I think we can probably dive down a little bit further into that.
Yeah, so I think ultimately the backbone of that trust is going to come from being able to prove that the high-risk systems are trained on the right data, that the organization has the ability to validate the output and the input, and to a degree what's going on inside. And I say to a degree because we ultimately don't really know what's going on inside a lot of the time, particularly with, again, non-deterministic inferential systems. But also to have a consistent process of testing that. And I can't emphasize enough that this might sound obvious, but you would be surprised the amount of organizations that I've worked with across the supply chain as a CISO, and including even the organizations that I ran, where it's tricky to have control and governance of that data, even in normal software sort of systems and software development processes. So I think this is going to become an even greater challenge when AI is ultimately going to reach into data and to systems using different identities in a way that we've not really explored before. Because we have often, I think at least up until recently, focused much of our objectives with controls to be autonomous, right? We try to build autonomous processes to shift from manual overhead. But now we're actually shifting from automation into autonomy. And that autonomy isn't full cognition, but it's we again, these AI agents now have a aspect of inference and the ability to correlate, do pattern recognition, and advanced analytical tasks that we definitely as human beings wouldn't be able to do within the same time frame or even at all potentially. And so as that technology innovation only strengthens, it also strengthens the intensity of the challenge for us to secure them and to govern it. And so one of the key principles that I think we're just going to have to get to grips with, and I'm not saying it's purely just because this is a lot of the foundational technology work that we do at Cyera, but this was something that I was seeing in my last CISO role only last year, which is the ability to provide more depth and granularity to the way that we understand our data. Call it data intelligence. And what I mean by that is, in the early years when I was trying to understand data, there was a lot of self-classifiers. You often give it to the hands of the end users, who then use those labels to circumvent DLP controls, poorly designed DLP controls. And the Bolden James, the Tituses, those systems of the world, I think, really defined what data classification was. And to a degree, I think it's almost bastardized the concept of data classification, because it can mean something so much more. It can really mean true data intelligence. And if you start fighting fire with fire, if you start applying machine learning, neural networks, and large language modeling, into solving the data problem, as AI is then using it for its own tasks, you can really begin to build a completely enriched picture of data that we've never really been able to get before. And you can kind of think of it as all the heuristics, the cluster of contextual information of a piece of data, where it sits, who can access it, what it how long it's existed throughout its life cycle, where it's been, how it's being used. And I think one of the really interesting innovations that we've definitely made is the learned classification concept. So it's also, again, back to those training those models, is being able to build AI that can actually learn in the right direction. And learned classifiers are a great example of this, where we can inspect data without having any prior knowledge of the organization or the environment, and we can still identify a new class of data, bespoke and unique to its context in the organization and where it resides. I think that's an amazing innovation. I think it's one of the many, and there are lots of others, that will be fundamentally necessary into operating securely with AI as it grows forward. So the approaches of like manual regex tuning and the burden that placed on teams, the attrition it caused for teams, again, I know this from personal experience, that is just going to have to go. And ultimately, we need to move to, because of the scale and pace of challenge, automated discovery, classification, and lineage tracking. And I think that this is going to be ultimately, the new command model for security decision making in the AI era.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, everyone loves a regex, and I'd hate that to disappear. But it is a truly powerful concept. Not just for that ongoing classification and being able to discover classified data based on its contents, but also, I guess, policing some of that. They talk about the early days of, well, do you know, why don't I just set this all to public, and then I've got no constraints. But also being able to do that review of data, particularly what's been identified as classified, to be able to police not just what end users are doing, but also that data that is being outputted from AI systems. That classic challenge of, well, actually, if it's got access to everything, does the label and classification carry across when it's a brand new document? And I know that was one of the early concerns that we had, or that we have. But having that powerful capability to automatically understand the data, classify it, I think it is going to become a must-have capability for all organizations, on top of that, understanding where and who's accessed it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So sort of moving on, in terms of the governance and taking control, I think and diving further down into the act, we can look at some of the key aspects.
You were almost doing a perfect segue anyway in the last point you made, which is that look, there are fundamental programs. I called them orphan security programs. They were programs which we picked up and essentially left to the side and never really solved for or got a grip with. And where the first was in understanding the data, the second is definitely understanding and governing identity. And again, a similar challenge has happened in that where we had pretty ring-fenced, controllable data input and output. Historically, that's now exponentially grown, not only from AI, but also with AI. And we can see the same thing happening with identity. And you can see this in the Act. The Article 10 is explicitly calling this out, that not only is personal data subject to all of these strict control measures, etc., but also there is a clear requirement, a mandate for access control to that data. And to ensure that the permissions associated with it are the right ones on a continuous basis. And I think really the why, the so what of why this is so important is because the transparency that's needed to build that trust that we spoke about earlier, that is ultimately going to hinge on these two things working well and in lockstep. The right identities with the right permissions under the right set of circumstances, accessing the right type of data for the time that they need to be doing it. And that's what's going to underpin every single decision-making process in the business. And it's part of the reason why decision sovereignty is shifting from the human down into, well, now when I say digital identities, to date, we really had human machine synergy at most. Okay, as a CTO, you must have thousands of service accounts. I used to as well.
We don't
But
talk about those.
exactly, we just part those. But historically, those are the things that we were only having to really interact with, and they're pretty rote-based, system accounts. That is now changing, where we've almost put those, we've doubled down on those accounts and given them again a form of cognition. I use that with an asterisk, but a definitely form of inferential analytical capability and autonomy, right? These AI agents can act autonomously. And those agents cluster together like beehives to form agentic orchestration. And that is where the autonomous processes are going to quickly become, almost self-governing unless we really begin to control this. And it's the reason why I'm pleased that the Act is calling this out, because, like you touched on, Richard, with IGA, this is just something we've never solved for. And the years we spent trying to deploy RBAC, and I'm sure everyone on this webinar has personal, probably very deep, painful, traumatic experience of these programs, where you're trying to categorize your AAD, your on-prem Active Directory, you're trying to glue it together with your Workday or whatever HR system you've got, your service management system, and then the host of both legacy and modern applications, and to try to get continuous lifecycle management on something as base what is conceptually as basic and straightforward as just controlling something, accessing something. Of course, it's not straightforward and it's not simple. But I think the challenge then, when we apply that to agentic orchestration, is again, a lot of the control architecture that we built for is going to break. We ultimately need to rethink the way we've structured it. I think, again, lofty objectives of things like attribute-based access control will have to become a mainstay of the way we govern identities going forward, that they will have to be able to execute circumstantial access based on exactly where they are in the environment, what they're doing, how they're going about doing it, for how long, what the output is, etc. And so I am expecting, and you're seeing this in the startup market at the moment, there's lots of brilliant new innovative companies. And again, it's a core part of the platform development focus within Cyera, is being able to build out true identity security posture management, build out the complete identity graph across your human, machine, and agent space. And I think that is going to be a really key, almost pillar of building that trust to in order to validate compliance with this act.
Yeah, no, I do. And I guess one of those, you probably put parallels with conditional access that we have right now, which is accessing, access to systems, access to network, but bringing that layer down to look at, well, actually, should that person right now have access to that data? Has that data become, more sensitive rather than just being pure? You have access to that file share. You have access to that area on SharePoint, which is obviously so broad in
Right.
access. Particularly as that the data within there can change depending on what people are putting in there. So I can see that being a challenge, a real challenge.
You've touched on another good theme, which I think we're covering off. You're very good at this like continuous segue, almost as if it's planned. But it's I think this like I think I'll touch it at the very end. But you're right that it's so circumstantial. I think that's a key point that in security we've not been brilliant at reflecting, because we've had a lot of static, very binary manual controls. I think in a lot of cases, data is now going to continuously change its state, its meaning, its nature, its construct. And so without adaptive, or what I would call reflexive controls, you're going to really struggle to govern that. And I can tell you the agents will get there quicker than you will. So I think that's just a challenge that we're going to have to contend with. I think like moving on to this piece is just wanted to begin to leave people with a sense of sort of where we are today with the Act and where we're going to be moving forward with, or where the EU certainly plans to move forward with this Act for organizations. So at the moment, the parts of the Act are already legally binding. So if you recall, at the very left-hand side of the risk categorization, those unacceptable categories are already banned. I think you can get a court order, I think, to deploy them, but I can't imagine most organizations are going to be needing to do that. I suspect the EU will work closely with those organizations that are probably deep into very advanced AI research that are looking to deploy such capabilities. And I think one of the really key points, though, is the phase two that's now legally binding, which is the obligations for general purpose AI models that I spoke about at the very start. And so these again are the typical generative models that we can think about using in our day-to-day lives, the GPTs, Perplexities, Geminis, etc. But also even things like Claude, right? So even when we look at the development work that goes on within organizations, a lot of the co-production and validation, I think, is still already being taking place with those models. I think one of the salient points for this, though, is the act doesn't yet necessarily put the full burden on the organization. Okay, it is actually, the onus is a lot on the supply chain. However, I think that is a good opportunity for organizations to really, again, try and evolve the way that we've done supply chain assurance. And like everybody here, I have put as much creative license into responding to DDQs as I'm sure you have over time, especially under pressure from the business.
No comment.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think this is a great time, and I would actively encourage this. It's, again, supply chain is something we're thinking about a lot at Sierra in terms of how we can build technology to tackle this problem. But I would encourage everyone to really work with early innovation startups in the market in some of these key areas, because I think the use cases are becoming so challenging. It's very hard to build technology in isolation. And these are problems that we A, have to solve for, and B, want to solve for. And there are some really exciting engineers that are really looking at this in the round. But I think we all acknowledge that the paper-based annual assurance exercises aren't going to be sufficient for validating the technology we're now leveraging from our supply chain as it becomes more almost disassociated from our control environment, but more critical in terms of dependency and interdependency across our processes within our organizations. So this is already in place. Really good opportunity to kind of get to grips with it now.
Yeah, and so you know, on our side, you know, we're embedding AI into a lot of our compliance practices. And at the best end of that being, you know, continuous. Say moving away from that paper exercise that is continuously being reviewed. So it's less ticking a box and more actually delivering on the objectives of many of the compliance standards overall. So I think it's important that we, I guess, it's some of that urgency that we need to consider. And as you say, it will, you know, slowly, you know, come down from, you know, it's at that high level at the, you know, the providers at the moment. But as it gets baked into more and more applications by organizations, then it will, you know, start to become a not just a supply chain issue.
Yeah.
So I guess our last piece that we cover off before we jump into the Q&A. I'm just looking at the time there that we're as always deep in conversation and time goes on, but importantly it's extremely interesting and important conversation that we're having. So I guess we've talked about a few of the problems, but let's look at some of that solution and how we can secure innovation, which actually is critically important. We're seeing, as you mentioned, really a boom in innovation that's being driven by this as a knock-on. I think when we looked at the security provider vendor landscape not that long ago, although we talk about being huge, actually starting to shrink a little bit as organizations got acquired or fell by the wayside. But now we're back into that boom as organizations are innovating, not just in the deployment of AI, but that securing of AI.
Yeah, I think you're going to see that for someone who tracks the market pretty much day in, day out. You're going to see that flux continue. I think part of that is a really positive trend, which is you're seeing shorter term exit strategies for innovative sort of engineering projects, you could almost call them, that scale up within 2 years and get acquired. And it's almost like outsourcing R&D to a degree. So you're seeing a lot of that in market. But I think part of that's because there are a lot of aspects of AI that need to be solved for, and you can't do everything. We're very specific about the areas that we're tackling, with the AI R&D work. We just released our research labs yesterday for the market. So, I think having a really clear scope of what you're going after to tackle is really going to help build effective controls. On the flip side of all of the sprawl in development, your organization budgets, and again, you're an internal CTO, I used to do that, I saw this all the time, you're consolidating stack, right? And I think for lots of organizations, the budgetary constraints are either we need to consolidate and extract maximum value out of the least amount of things that we need, or it's going to be show me the money in the sense of the ROI on these initiatives. I think it's a great opportunity for the CISO for the security function and for the technologist to have with the business over actually, we need more staff to solve for this AI. As long as you're convinced that the return on those use cases from AI is going to be sufficient, then this could be a really successful joint venture. We should be having that conversation. We should be, I spent most of my time with my CFO and CRO. That is the kind of language that we're going to have to engage in because, again, like I mentioned with the consumer, the business are interfacing with this technology day in, day out now, and the behavior of that is going to change the types of engagement and discussions they're going to require with internal technologists. So we can't just sit and sort of hope they're going to continue to give us more money. We're going to have to really fight for it. But there's amazing opportunity for innovation within that space. And really here, the just last takeaway points is obviously the act is going to get more heavy and more burdensome as time goes on, obviously, as different types of systems do deploy. Maybe some of those timelines actually are expedited based on events. It's difficult to say at the moment. That's certainly the timeline that EU have given. I think again, back to the very first point, I think Richard, you made it on the first slide, like this regulatory compliance, right, is no longer just a nice to have. I think it is going to become a fundamental part of the trust and a fundamental competitive edge for businesses as they move forward. And so my last sort of point really is just that, again, it's not so much summer hygiene, but there are real basics that we need to, basic concepts that we need to get a grip with. But I think we need to re-engineer the way that we think about them. So we have to be able to actually do proper inventorying and discovery, which we, again, have not been brilliant with. When I looked at the state of my former CMDB, I can understand, right? But we really need to do that with AI and across, again, those pipelines, applications, models, identities. I think assessing loss exposure and opportunity return across any initiative, that is the discussion the business wants you to have. It is not sufficient enough to be using mental gut models of red, amber, greens. We need to be talking in pounds, dollars, and looking at actually the probabilities of success for these initiatives the business wants to deploy AI you in and how we're going to secure that and make that a reality. I think, again, we touched on this. The control environment that we've built was brilliant or good enough for its age. It is now need to going to be fundamentally re-architectured. And I think agentic AI will break the back off of existing control designs. And so even our governance models are going to have to move and adapt with the changing nature of our data and the changing nature of our estate. So adaptive governance will become a key concept. And I think finally is maintaining observability. It's a bit of a buzzword, but I think it's an important concept that we need to just know what's going on with as much of our AI operations as possible. And I think at the moment, that's just very difficult. So I think that's something that is definitely something we're focused on at Cyera. But it's also something I think that more broadly, the market and every organization is going to focus on when it comes to building the controls to govern this moving forward.
Brilliant. I think that's a great way to capture, I guess, some of the thoughts and actions and things we need to think about. I will just jump into the Q&A if I can find where that's hiding, as we do have some questions that have come in, and obviously we do have a little bit of time left, only a tiny bit. So if you do have any further questions, please ask. So the first question is, how can modern enterprises effectively catalog and classify all AI systems across complex multi-cloud environments to accurately determine which fall into unacceptable, high, limited, and minimal risk under the Act, especially given the prevalence of shadow IT? Actually, that's probably quite an important point. Shadow IT and legacy systems, the bane of any CMDB and understanding where your data is.
Yeah, so I mean, we have this concept at Cyera of like raiding the environment. So I think our core thesis as a technology is that we want to understand data anywhere, everywhere that it lives. And I think at least when I looked at the data programs that I worked on with my CDO historically, we never really wanted to take that approach because we knew it was impossible. We sort of stuck to structured data that we knew where it existed. I think now, though, even when I look at some of what I would like to think of as like sort of clean repos, even those are becoming increasingly complex. And to your point, Richard, when you look at the almost disintegration of the traditional estate architecture, those repos now exist all over the place. And I certainly looked at this with the sort of network architecture changes that we were making post-COVID. I've now got data sat on devices all over the world. I've now got it sat in different shared repos, different hybrid architectures between my on-prem environments and the CSPs that I'm working with. And that makes it super complex. And that data is now structured, unstructured, and increasingly non-standardized, right? So this is like the point I was mentioning earlier with the learned classifiers, right? I think that the type of controls that we have to deploy going forward for discovering and analyzing data to build that intelligence have to be intuitive enough to understand the data itself when it's inspected and not rely on other things to, or at least other predetermined rules to understand it or predetermined information. So inspecting data where it exists, the context around it, and all of those heuristic attributes that I spoke about, the identities accessing it, the type of access permissions that are associated with it, its existence over its entire lineage, and its changing state, that is going to be crucial. And I think one of the key points that I'll make about this as well is, I think if I could encourage anyone, it's not about shifting to, again, binary classifiers of sensitive and non-sensitive. Yes, those are important. But actually, a lot of the work that we do is build a complete picture of all sorts of attributes of a piece of data, perhaps even its compliance state with various pieces of legislation. It could be its utilization as part of an internal, you know, as a piece of intellectual property, as part of their own internal R&D process. It can be all sorts of really unique things and aspects. I think data is very interesting, and I don't think we've done a very good job at unpicking all the interesting parts about it. And the so what, again, for that is that it's not just going to rapidly improve the efficacy of your existing security stack, because everything is relying on that inspection of that data. If you look at your DLP, the reason there are so many false positives is it's pretty crude at being able to understand that. And again, that's another area we've learned a lot of R&D work into. But ultimately, it's going to ignite all of the data programs across your business. So not even traditional security ones, whether it's cataloging, privacy, literacy, e-discovery, DSARS, all of these things are ripe for being massively innovated, and all of it lies in that data intelligence at rest. So I think looking at deploying more modern, effective, scalable mechanisms for discovering and understanding your data, I think that is going to be, honestly, 75% of the work for a lot of what the Act and these kind of requirements are asking for.
Yeah, no, indeed. And you mentioned DSAR there, and anyone that's been involved in one of those will know how painful that process can be. That's not an IT issue. We are rapidly running out of time. I'm just going to grab two more questions. So one of them is, how would you suggest evangelizing the impact and risk to compliance outside the EU, given the extraterritorial applicability of the AI Act, which I think actually is quite an important question. And I suppose there's all different aspects to it of, whether it's holding EU citizen data, is that being transferred outside of the EU and beyond?
Like, you're 100% touching on some of the right points there. I think the world's getting smaller in many ways. And the at least when I look at organizations that not only we work with in Sahara, but the ones across the banking supply chains I used to work in, etc., I come across very few now that have zero touch point to any region, whether it's through M&A activity, so acquiring and divesting businesses, whether it's through their supply chains, whether it's through even exploring new regions, right? So I used to do lots of risk modeling in one of my asset management businesses on, would we actually deploy offices to a new region based on the type of threat landscape for that? I think all of these things are going to play a critical role in gluing those sort of extraterrestrial businesses that are outside of, extraterritorial businesses outside of the EU region and their connections with engaging in business activity there. Like I said, I think it's pretty unlikely there's going to be zero touch point. And to be honest, I think, Richard, you mentioned this at the start, but with the question that this legislation will grow into other regions. It's not as if even the US or other regions won't have a form of this legislation. So if anything, this is going to put organizations on the front foot. There will be a clear commercial advantage as well, because trust is going to become at the very forefront of the consumer's mind when it comes to engaging with services from organizations. And part of that trust is almost seeded by being able to self-certify to these pieces of regulation. So I think the quicker organizations can do that, even proactive, looks even better. I think that will be a really key way of selling that kind of advantage of actually, this is the kind of standards of practice that we're holding ourselves to.
Yeah, indeed. So we're 3 minutes from the hour. I think what we'll do is there's a couple more questions, but we will answer those in a follow-up, as we haven't really got too much time, and I'm sure everybody has got meetings to get to on the hour. Just before we close out, just we do have some more webinars coming up this week. So on Thursday, in fact, I'm sitting down having a chat with Francis Gorman from the Bank of Ireland and host of the Entropy podcast about all things quantum, as that's his area of focus. And also, core trends in redefining MDR in 2026. So I think that is it from us. So I'm just going to say thank you very much to Ash. You've been a brilliant guest on the webinar and obviously extremely knowledgeable in this area. And to say thank you to everybody that joined. And hopefully see you again very soon on our next webinar. Thank you.